The talk is really about IT systems in the context of integrated surveillance. So first, a couple of housekeeping. I'm employed by Northrop Grumman. I currently own stocks, and I'm currently working on the CDC contract supporting the National Center for HIV/AIDS, viral hepatitis, sexually transmitted diseases, and tuberculosis elimination. Which takes me to my next slide. I would like to acknowledge our partners, or colleagues at CDC, Tom Sukolak and Doug Correll, who have actually been very supportive and helped us shape the content of this presentation. First thing I want to talk about is really how IT, since the beginning, or since the computers have actually made themselves or found their way into public health, how they have helped public health. For example, they have been right there side by side talking about or collecting and aggregating data. During budget crunches, IT steps in again, helping you to do more with less. And now we actually are seeing a shift where organizations want to begin to integrate diseases or integrate disease domains. And again, IT is taking that particular, is taking those steps to help figure out the solution. And obviously, IT then has other benefits. It improves data sharing and quality. It increases the agility and the ability to deliver better services because now you can reconfigure your systems to deal with new public health outbreaks or public health events. It helps detect, monitor, and track and correlate data. And also, you can begin, from an integrated perspective, you can begin looking at a syndemic approach to prevention. This is some information that we actually got from an MMWR report that talks about since 2007 since 2007 to 2010, there's been a 22% increase in integrated systems. And in the same time period, there were 200% increase on interoperable systems. Even the center that I'm working for, NCHHSDP, last year, I believe it was in November, they hosted a two-day meeting, and there was 60 external partners that attended the event. And their purpose was to share, contribute to their, to their surveillance consultations. There were six items that actually we felt that were important. First, the consultation or the outcomes where the leadership should be involved more in standardizing public health data. There should be systems that break down silos. What's happening right now is that we have a lot of systems that are based on unique needs. There has to be an increase in interoperability and harmonization. We need to facilitate collaboration between public health partners, provide guidance, and eventually also develop a workforce in public health informatics at the local state level. So what we did through the work that we're doing at CDC and providing the technical assistance to public health departments, what we've done is we put together a roadmap. And what this roadmap allows you to do, or at least organization, is really the beginning of, it provides you with lessons learned in the beginning of what you actually have to do when thinking of an integrated strategy. For example, identifying your key factors that influence public health, and we'll discuss this in a second. Or maybe looking at your organization internally and externally and see how you have to reconfigure your departments to work in an integrated manner. Looking at your current IT systems and figuring out where you are and where you want to go. Then also identifying your risk and figuring out ways to mitigate those risks. And then eventually what you do is you'll put together recommendations that will give you a blueprint that will allow you to eventually create an integrated environment. So in the first part of our journey, we're going to be looking at the key factors. So as we're working, we identified four areas. And now this may not apply to you. You may have other areas. But, for example, what we've looked at is leadership priorities need to be considered. We need to, in many cases, again, these are examples. In many cases, what you see are leadership Can I have some water, please? I apologize. What leadership wants to make sure that those systems or integrated strategy is aligned with the mission. It integrates all the diseases and is usually looking at one system. They're also worried about confidentiality and making sure that there are efficiencies in order they want to be able to measure the progress and figure out, am I really getting something out of this integration? Now, public health programs and initiatives, those are the most critical part of your integration. They're the stakeholders. They're the ones that actually should be driving the integration. They need to shape that integration. Then system design and integration, those are the IT components. Again, IT shouldn't lead this, but rather they become enabler of your integration strategy. And in this case, your IT organization needs to understand the design, the resources required, the security requirements, how to support it, and is it something that we can expand over time as new activities occur within your organization. And eventually, integration is also important. You need to make sure that you can have an efficient data exchange, interoperability, and whether or not APIs or application program interfaces are required so that you can share your data between organization and between yourself. The next step is really looking at your organization. And this is something that you look inside and outside. As we're working with CDC and worked with the public health department, we identified that the strengths of the organization is that they have very good epi surveillance and research activities, and in most cases they have very, very creative people. But some of the weaknesses, and maybe this might not apply to you, are IT fragmentation. What happens is that systems are developed at the program level, and eventually the program tosses them over into the IT environment, and the IT is stuck having to actually work and do the care and feeding. Knowledge is also something that is important, because what we see sometimes is that systems that have been developed over the last 10 or 15 years, the knowledge is very limited, and therefore that could also represent a risk. Then, of course, the silos and the policies can be a weakness, and sometimes the policies themselves will actually hinder the integration, but you can always find ways to work around those policies. Looking externally, healthcare reforms could be certainly an opportunity, but liberating data is actually the more important thing here. What we do is a lot of times, IT spends a lot of time building systems, making sure they're secured, and then what they do is they cage this data, and it has no way of escaping. So liberating it and allowing it to flow to other areas in your organization, of course, within reason, or going outside organization will help your integration strategy. Of course, some of the threats could be constrained budgets, and of course, categorical funding, which goes right in line with policies. Sometimes there are policies that will prevent you, but again, looking closely at your organization and identifying what you can or cannot do will help you with an integration strategy. The next step is really IT systems. And in here, really, you're looking at two things. You're looking at your current landscape. How are your system built? A lot of programs have built over the years considerable amount of capacity in being able to collect their data. But in some cases, there are also some duplicative systems and outdated technology that also represents a risk. Systems collect similar data in different formats. So what happens is that we have a code is a code is a code, but it's a different code in a different system. So what you have to do is figure out ways on how you're going to harmonize this data. And IT is usually burdened more and more to support it. But your strategy of looking at your current landscape doesn't stop here. You actually have to look at further down the line. How new ways of socializing or discovering data will affect your strategy. So don't just look at what you're trying to integrate right now, but figure out what you're going to need in the future. So, for example, mobility is pressuring IT. And it's not a matter of if mobility is going to come into public health department, but when. Furthermore, technology is also creating new expectations. So if you think about it, everyone is carrying a mobile device. And so those type of devices are creating a new sense of expectation from your users. So over and over, it's harder and harder to keep up. So here, looking at this thing will help identify strategy. The next thing is risk. And integration is hard, and it's quite a big process. We have identified four areas that you should be looking at. People, and in this particular case, what you need to do is you really need to assemble the right team when you're doing an integration strategy. You also have to balance the needs. What we've noticed is that some areas of public health organizations have more resources than others, and therefore sometimes their voices are much louder. And therefore, that's where leadership gets involved and figures out how to balance those needs and figure and move forward. Complexity. A lot of these systems are being compartmentalized. They have unique needs. Don't forget the unique needs. You can't say, I'm going to have a one-size-fits-all. Identify those needs and put them in your roadmap. Try not to rush to integrate. Integration is not a sprint, but rather a marathon. And make sure that you have, that you continuously, gather requirements. And, of course, resources can also be a risk. Funding, infrastructure, and what we mean by this is, your actual data centers that will be running your integration. You need to figure out if you have the right infrastructure and can you sustain it over time. Next is really some of the recommendations. So again, in building an integration strategy, what you want to do is you want to align your strategy to your executive priorities, your public health programs and initiatives, and making sure that your architecture and integration are aligned as well. You want to constantly communicate your vision and objectives to your stakeholders. You need to make sure that you identify and engage your public health programs, because those are the ones that are going to be guiding and making sure that the strategy will work for them. You also want to develop unique evaluation criteria, and those are the differentiators between different areas of your diseases. Develop an RFI, or a request for information, to identify what is out there already that people are using, and then see if that actually will help in your integration strategy. And make sure that you always involve IT and informatics early and often. And if you're interested in doing this blueprint, then we think that you should rethink how public health informatics should be integrated across diseases to help deliver services. Periodically reevaluate and adjust your approach. And again, the reason being is because what you know now will probably evolve over time as you're going through this integration strategy. You want to develop your customized blueprints. So department, public health department X blueprint will be different from the department Y. Make sure that you figure out ways of liberating data while respecting your privacy and confidentiality guidelines. Actively gather and validate requirements. Now, considering governance. Governance is an interesting topic here. What we believe governance is where public health programs are actually driving, and they are actually at the seat of the governance committee. IT will participate, but they're more like they are the enabler. So in conclusion, there's three things that if there is anything that you've learned here today, there are three things. Integration is a lifestyle. Integration is a team sport, and integration is a marathon. Thank you.
I want to thank our three presenters, and they present different topics that are thinking beyond the traditional ways that in public health we have approached being part of the conversation, collecting the data, and being able to look at it in an integrated approach. I'd like to open it up for any questions that the audience may have. Yes, sir.
Targeting maybe 55 to 65, let's say for maybe the colorectal cancer screening, I wouldn't use the Facebook channel for that. But or then Twitter, or if I'm targeting youth, I'd probably use Twitter, or probably use some of the other channels that youth are now beginning to merge to. So we're constantly doing research with each other. survey who's actually on social media, what channels are they using for that?
I think my question was important for this. I think what I want to ask is what kind of strategies have you seen in place that kind of target users that are target populations that you want to reach that use social media but maybe don't use it as frequently? For example, like college students that are really busy, but you want to get a message to them. Have you found specific ways that catch their attention in the limited time that you have?
We do. One of the things that we do is try to partner with organizations, partner with schools to get that information out. I can say at CDC they have a student ambassador program where they're trying to merge traditional, like social media, into their curriculum in school. It's a communication program with UGA. So they're looking to have them be student ambassadors and begin to utilize social media to send health messages out for CDC. So I think looking at whether or not people are using social media channels actively, looking at other areas to still reach them, I think is still just as important. So you're not totally like throwing away your traditional media. You're still using that. You may be incorporating videos. You may be incorporating your PSAs, but you're still just kind of evolving your communication strategy to include social media because so many people are on social media.
I know during H1N1, which, you know, we know that was affecting the college population quite a bit. So not only using YouTube, there was a hand-washing video, but also using Twitter and Facebook, but also getting the universities to retweet that to the people they're following. So that partnership really, really has to happen to improve the efficacy of that. There was another question. Yes.
To what extent has law limited your ability to collect information from non-traditional sources, and how do you work through that?
Tim, do you want to?
What's the question?
How does the law limit your ability to take information that is out there on these channels and use it?
Well, so far I've been using just Twitter data, so that's publicly available data, and we work in this initial pilot project with the State Department of Health. So we're working through their authorities and their responsibilities. So we're following their mission and their practice and the extent to which they're able to collect data based on their ability to use that data. So one of the obstacles, for example, and the diagram pointed to that, is we're considering an option with Tennessee that they would trigger, based on a tweet, is there a way to trigger a response, a retweet, back to that source to ask them to provide more information or to enroll in a health department, you know, online website. So there's mixed reviews. There may be some limitations on doing that because effectively then the health department will be polling a population that hasn't presented themselves yet to the health department, but yet they volunteered that information publicly. So those are, I mean, this is one example of a lot of issues we've got to deal with before we can determine, you know, how could we use it to interact with individuals in the community rather than using the information broadly. The project thus far has used information broadly to use indicators, again, not as the primary source, not as the drug reporting system, but really just to characterize and amplify the other traditional information that says maybe something going on and ask the question, is there some community level information that amplifies that and says yes, there is.
And there are services available to take Twitter data and de-identify it, essentially. And that way you can use it for trending. So there's, you know, Candace and Tim present almost two sides of that same coin. How do you join in the conversation? And actually, I'd like to ask Candace, you're going to join in the conversation. How do you know that people are actually listening?
Well, I think
I didn't tell her I was going to ask her that question, so.
Easier through Twitter, but I think if you're let's say that you have a Twitter channel and you're sending out messages, and if you're constantly monitoring who is retweeting your posts, if you're constantly monitoring who is mentioning your organization in tweets and sending them out, what comments are they saying, then you can begin to see, number one, who are your influencers? Who are people who are your advocates for your health information, if that's what you're sending out, or if your brand, whatever it is, who are those champions that are going to send your message out? And then you start directly targeting them. One of the things that I've helped in the program that I work for is we start categorizing those influencers. Is it public health departments? Or is it clinicians that are looking for information? Is it students in public health programs or in other health-related programs, public health-related programs that are looking for information for a research paper or for a project or things like that? Is it someone looking for information for their elderly parent? So you begin to categorize them and you can see, well, we have a lot of people that are looking for information related to H1N1. Or if it's an example of an emergency situation, let's take like the fungal meningitis outbreak that happened a while back. Are people just really looking for information for themselves? You know, are they saying, hey, you know what, I think I might have been exposed. What is it that I need to do? So just really looking at who those people are. And then if you're continuously monitoring, you'll start noticing a trend. Like this person or these group of people are continuously engaging with our content. We really need to pay attention to who they are. And you start adding them or maybe inviting them to other social media channels. You know, even if you're on Facebook, let's say you're on Twitter, you can still advertise the stuff that you're doing on Facebook. You know, you just kind of have to be creative with your tweet. But so then you're inviting people to engage with your organization on other media, social media channels. And you're kind of building your brand and building that engagement.
So if you have an active social media strategy and you're monitoring, then if the work that Tim and his team are doing with the state of Tennessee see some trends from the Twitter data they're using, they could reach out through the network that you already have established. So you're not retweeting back to the tweeters that are saying they have a stomach ache or all the other things the college students would say, but you're using your established Twitter network.
Right, and I think it's a combination of the two. I know for us, we're constantly monitoring social media channels. So if I see something that someone may post, well, for example, there was a TB outbreak in LA a couple of months ago, and I saw it on Twitter over the weekend and sent it to a program to say, hey, there's several people, not four, not a lot, but I've seen four mentions about this TB outbreak in LA. I'm not sure if there's anything going on, but I just want to give it to you as an FYI, a heads up. Lo and behold, within about a week later, it actually turned out to be a larger outbreak. So again, if you're sometimes monitoring and you see something that has the potential to be something, someone mentioning an outbreak, or you see that a large number of people are talking about illness in a particular city, you can begin to say, okay, well then maybe this is a trend. Maybe, you know, we need to watch this a little bit more. Maybe we need to start searching their local news and what's happening around that city to see if there is a trend in disease outbreak.
Tim, do you have something to add?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, and as we're talking about the kinds of information Dan just mentioned and the process that Max described going through, the common thread there is we're looking at changing information. The kinds of information that's available is constantly changing. Traditional information is changing how it's reported, but more importantly, the dynamics around more and more people having more and more devices producing more and more content. Some of it, individual community social media data, and some of it biologically, more early electronic and medical record reports about potential complaints that have to be analyzed and translated. And we're certainly getting more laboratory assay information that's coming from the genomics platforms and proteomics platforms that are going to be saying, here we think we've got something. I'm saying all that the information is increasingly going to be unproven when you start to use it. It's going to be earlier in the information cycle, so you're going to have a lot of different pieces of unproven or somewhat proven or increasingly proven or verified information relating to an outbreak, whether it's flu, whether it's foodborne, whether it's a biothreat. No matter what that information is relative to a community status, it's going to come from a lot of different sources, and the algorithms and the analytics and the platforms are going to take in huge amounts of data from multiple streams, from multiple types, and rapidly analyze that and present that to a decision maker. So in many ways, that's the little small, roll up your sleeves and figure it out with Tennessee we're working on. How do you make that work in one practice area, but with the anticipation of how you scale that to the other kinds of threats, the other kinds of information, and get ahead of this revolution of the genomics assays. They're going to present information very early in that cycle, and you're going to have to respond to it very quickly. So you have to do that in the context of other information to determine whether or not you have something actionable or not. That's a challenge for public health, and it's a challenge for health, and it's a challenge for decision makers. And we feel like it all helps. This process we're describing helps to get ahead of that entire curve, not just one program, my program, my program, but across a spectrum of challenges for public health.
Yes, the woman in the back.
Purchasing 26 weeks of data, but then it's publicly available, so who are you purchasing from?
There are a variety of vendors you can purchase that from. That was specifically for this first case, this first trial, point in time data we bought it for 26 weeks to do analysis on. As we go forward, we have to look at, and there are methods and contracts for purchasing the streaming data. You know, any data that's 30 minutes old is considered public. So, you know, you could purchase contracts, or you can, you know, grab a snapshot of data on an ongoing basis, you know, by geography, by type, and then run your analysis against that. So we have to figure out, again, back to the question of what's needed based on the value, the types of data for areas to determine what is the investment needed to make that practical and sustainable. And probably it becomes a matter of looking at multiple places, multiple states, large scale, you know, access to that data, and then the analytics to support the smallest decision level necessary.
But it's companies other than Twitter that are pulling that part of the data.
And then you can also sift. So we give them some keywords. It turns out we had to ask the college students and our families what some of the keywords are when you have a stomach virus, but and then which ones we could actually repeat.
No, my other question actually for the keywords, are you limited to hashtags or are you searching anything?
And we actually are searching the words and the strings, and a key thing is, for example, you can't just use one word. You've got to use word plus word plus word to have any reality. Yeah, but you're right. Some of the words you have to use are colorful words, realistically. So,
no, it does not.
And I think one of the strategies I found with helpful is I think of all the ways that people could possibly say this particular, you know, not everybody uses the word influenza. In fact, most people don't use the word influenza unless you're working in public health or you're a healthcare professional. So, you know, using flu or using other terms. And then the thing about the data sets too is a lot of this information is public. So you can go onto Twitter and just do a search on a particular topic and it'll pull a string. But with Twitter, it's limited, so you can only pull about 2 days worth of data. But if you're looking for a larger data set, if you're looking to pull information back, let's say 3 months or even 6 months, that's something that you have to purchase.
Who's going to ask the question about reliability? You've got to be thinking it, right? You know, like, how reliable is this data? Is this just the new thing? And how are you going to prove that it's reliable? Does anyone have that question? No? Oh, you did. Good. I thought maybe nobody was thinking that.
That's like on a related note, maybe, as much as
people
really tweet about vomiting and having diarrhea?
People tweet about
it.
Oh, you
can. Yeah. 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 How reliable is it?
Well, you saw the indication from the initial analysis. I mean, those keywords appeared enough that it statistically was valid to say there's an indication of something going on in that community.
I mean, that's part of the driver for working with the state of Tennessee, Tim and his team, to actually, okay, this seems like it could influence how public health responds or how public health can be involved, and answer that question from like 8 years ago, why does CNN know before anybody else? So, but, you know, being part of, you know, and supporting the public health mission, we really wanted to get some proof points. And that's the purpose of our work with Tennessee. Yes?
I had a question in regard to integrated surveillance. And can you talk a little bit about liberating data in different formats? Can you give it like an example of how that would happen
those are actually, that's a very good question. And really, each public health department is going to have their unique need. For example, we work with one health department that there were some preconceptions that certain things could not be shared across diseases. So what happens is, so one of the things that you need to do when you're doing this strategy is really start looking at the assumptions that you know, you've been working on and figure out, are they really still true? So in this particular case, what they did is they actually went back to legal or to counsel and decided, are there any reasons why it's a communicable disease and HIV couldn't talk to each other? And they found out there really wasn't a reason that they could. So it becomes really a unique opportunity for each health department within, you know, the laws that are being governed. I don't know if that helps or not.
Because some of the, you know, historically, what we were able to do 15, 20, 25, 30 years ago in IT to protect data and to secure the data, there have been so many advances, but people still remember what we had to do to meet the letter of the law. So going back to the law actually helps in the liberating process. I love that phrase. At the woman in purple.
My question goes back to the discussion about reliability, and I was wondering if you had done an analysis maybe of slightly older Twitter data to see if where those spikes in the timing of when an outbreak occurs, if that parallels other data that's available to say, okay, well, I see the spike and it's in week 11, and if I look at older data for the same time period from a different data source, I see the spike.
Yeah, we are, and I'll let Tim answer also, but we are also looking at different data streams, so different data points, like from WebMD, and what they have from their data of what people were searching on. Tim, do you have more?
Yeah, so we're looking both at overlaying the reported case clusters with Tennessee that line up with the incidence of the occurrence of those patterns that you saw, but also looking at syndromic data and other reporting and other indicators. So again, this was the first thing. So now we're building a relational approach with Tennessee to say, what are the next query questions we're going to put together against that data, and what are we going to use it to reference against the other reported and established data that they already had about events that have occurred, and then use that as a forward-looking approach to earlier question about how do you then begin to build that into an operating process that will begin to inform going forward. I mean, the whole idea behind this is not to do a retrospective analysis and say there was an association, but rather look forward and say that using that as a capability, you could inform decision-making with outbreaks before you know it's an outbreak. So before you have the historical reported data, that this information is evolving and emerging and maturing and has some reliability for certain conditions or certain approaches. So that's the intent, is to show that value in practice, not just to do the analytics to say there was an association, but to do the next step, which says there's so what here as far as informing and changing practice.
You had a question in the back? Yes.
With CMS meaningful use, obviously it sets the stage for sharing of data between state and local health departments, I mean, with electronic health records dumping in the state and local health departments. Of course, many states don't have that capability yet. But beyond infectious disease, I work in the Center for Injury Prevention and Control. There's a lot of capability beyond outbreak control. It's looking at viruses that have been used to look at suicidal ideation, older up falls, prescription drug overdose right now is a big epidemic that's not reportable, so many states currently don't have to report that, but via EHRs and meaningful use, there's that capability now of utilizing syndromic surveillance data from EHRs to figure out where states are that may not even have a statewide surveillance system. I was wondering what type of capability is being provided to the states, period, and then also as it relates to TIFLIS and other algorithms for non-infectious etiologies. It's a pretty broad question.
Dr. Sam Shaker is sitting right behind you, and I think you've just put a plug in for Sam's session at 12:30.
Oh.
But I think that brings up the whole concept of what's being known as big data, how do you take multiple streams of data, a lot of data, and how do you ingest it and then make it meaningful? And, you know, we have developed a platform, an analytic platform. And if you go to our booth, Dr. Jay Schindler will actually talk more about our health analytics platform, but how you take those pieces of data and make it meaningful. So it's not just about disease outbreak, but being able to use it for chronic disease, for injury, and to make it actionable. Priscilla?
So that actually is a great segue to my question. Back when I was in the state health department prior, in historical terms, the biggest barrier in terms of stakeholders was spelled CDC. So I'm curious whether when we're talking about MDHHSTP engaging in terms of surveillance systems, whether that engagement spread further than that center or even infectious disease.
So I'll take it. Put us on the spot with our customer. No. And actually, when we were meeting with our customer on this, they are big proponents of integrated surveillance. They realize they play a role in moving this conversation forward. And it is part of their plan of action. And Matt?
Yeah, I think actually, his name escapes me, but he's the new director of OSOS, I think Dr.
Chesney Richards.
I believe he's actually been asked to develop some type of strategic plan over the next 90 days to move forward the conversation of integrated surveillance, and I think it's right now it's for notifiable diseases. So they are. I think it's on the radar. The question, like I was saying before, it's a marathon. If you start, sprinting, you run out of gas, and then you're left in the middle of the road.
Let me add too that center by center, they're struggling with this in their own way. You know, and I know and love my brother and the CDC. So, you know, leading that part was challenging. But as we started discussing this about foodborne and the challenges of foodborne, my colleagues at OPHBR raised their hand and said, that's exactly what we're trying to do in detection preparedness areas. And then you started talking with the hepatitis and TB guys, and they've all been talking about the how to. So it's not a if, it's a when. And I think the expanding data and the availability of clinical data, as the colleague mentioned back here, that clinical data is earlier in the cycle, it's more reliable, mm-hmm. particularly if you impose some algorithms that start to refine that and push that into practice. Electronic lab reporting is early. All that information feed says you cannot wait any longer. You cannot afford to have siloed surveillance systems. You've got to enable integrated because the economy and efficiency and the decision support that comes from that start with the economy. States don't have funding, you know, the technology now lets it be integrated and functional, but at the same time you can persist and protect the data. So I think there's a confidence that lets people now make those decisions, but the drivers of the economy, they have to consolidate it. And that's why that little exercise we're talking about here in Tennessee is the notion of how much can we actually build into a machine and make the machine function? You know, make it that automated so it's presented in a more refined form when it's first used.
And how do you take what's incredibly manual and takes a lot of the public health professionals' time and move that to technology so they can spend the time they need to do those analytics? Any other questions? I'm not going to call them for someone again. No, I'm just teasing. Yeah. Any other questions for our presenters? I want to thank you all very much for attending, but I would like to introduce Dr. Sam Shaker. Sam, would you stand? He's our chief medical officer at our health practice at Northrop Grumman, and he's actually going to be moderating our 12:30 session. Sam, do you want to say a few words about that?
Thank you, Alexis. And again, Alexis is our public health unit director, and we're tag teaming. She's covering core public health functions today, and I think we had a wonderful panel, and yeah, we should definitely have and then we're moving the 12:30 to 2 session into the integration of public health and healthcare. So the question you asked about meaningful use, we actually run the data system.
Thank you.